Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are back talking COVID-19. As we enter day one of our 6-week lockdown, Martin, how are things?
I haven't stepped outside the door, so I don't really know. You know, I'll check it out when I step outside the door. I was asking you what way is it looking, and you were saying there was quite a bit of traffic on the road still this morning.
Yeah, no, I was kind of. I'm running 26 miles, 26.2 on Sunday, guys, to complete my my run 2020 challenge, which means hopefully by this time, yeah, it should be about 12:30 on Sunday afternoon, I should have completed 2,020 miles in 2020 to raise money for Inner City Helping Homeless and Anna Liffey. Just here's, forget the plug about the Patreon at the moment. If you go to the Tortoise Shack and you hit any of the donate buttons, the money is going directly to Inner City Helping Homeless and Anna Liffey. Look, set out to do this in late December, spoke to the guys, and now basically it's the equivalent of 78 marathons and I'm almost there. I can't believe I'm almost there, but I'm going to finish it on Sunday. So there's the bit of self-praise out of the way. Much more importantly, we're delighted to be rejoined on the podcast by China policy and regulatory expert, doctor and geneticist, and two-time champion on the podcast, Paul. Sorry if something stuck in my throat. Paul O'Brien. Paul, thanks so much for talking to us again.
Pleasure, Tony.
Listen, first and foremost, you are right now in your quarantine phase. Do you want to just give listeners an idea of where you are and how and what the process has been like?
Okay, so I'm in the center of Shanghai City in Huangpu District. I'm in Hongkou District, actually. So I'm pretty much bang in the center of Shanghai. And I would have got here 6 days ago. Basically, the whole process of getting into China at the moment, it starts at even applying for the visa. So China's not really issuing visas for most people at the moment. So the process is fairly vigorous in terms of vetting you getting into the country. So that's their kind of first checkpoint. And as soon as they issue you the visa, that's where the real magic starts. So first of all, I have to get a negative PCR 72 hours before I board the plane. So I go to my local testing facility, the same as anyone would test in Ireland. I get referred by my GP, and then I go to the swabbing centre, get that done, get the result. But I have to actually send the results to the Chinese embassy in Ireland. They actually certify that and issue me with a health declaration that's stamped by the embassy. I have to bring that then when I'm actually going boarding or going through security check in Dublin Airport. And from there, basically, the next step is they do temperature checking. So they let me on the plane at that stage. Once I arrive in China, you'll actually see on the plane, if you look around you, there's about four or five people. They'll be in full PPE. So that's the full onesies. The actual, obviously the masks, they've got goggles and then a full head shield around as well. I was wondering, I thought it was a bit overkill for passengers, but it turns out they're actually government officials that are assigned to the plane. And as soon as you're ready to disembark, they'll go around and double check that you have all your, health passport done. So basically, I forgot to mention, before you do actually get on the plane, you have to scan a QR code. And basically, that QR code, it piggybacks off an existing app in China, which is kind of like WhatsApp. It's called WeChat, but it's got a lot more functionality than WeChat would have, or than WhatsApp would have. So that gives you this kind of health passport that syncs in with their contact tracing for your geolocation and with your health information. So they'll scan that, and then they'll actually they disinfect the plane as everyone's getting off with this ionized hydrogen peroxide. As soon as you get off, they do another temperature check, and then they escort you to the second PCR. So before you actually go through to get your baggage, you're taking another PCR. They put that QR code onto your passport, and that's all scanned through. So I get my bags, you get outside, and then they have more officials waiting, and they take you to your hotel. So they bring you to it. It's a supervised hotel. The hotels are all managed by the local hospitals in each of the districts. And basically they take you up to a room and they say, we'll see you in 14 days. And over the course of each day, you'll get three square meals. So morning, you'll just hear a noise. You go outside and there's a meal waiting for you. And that's the process for the next 14 days. And each day then I have to do two temperature checks and upload that using the QR code. And then at the end of all this, I'll do my final PCR test. And if that's negative, I'm given basically a green light on my health passport, which means I can travel freely through the country. Like when they're doing the QR scans at various points, I'll be scanned and able to go through. Whereas if I had a negative report or if there was a possibility of a risk, I wouldn't be able to go through. So that's the whole process. You can see it's fairly crazy, to be honest, but it's working for China anyway.
It's absolutely, like, in one regard, it's admirable. It's really admirable. And in another regard, it's almost, oh my God, like freedom of movement and, you know, civil liberties. Is this just, I know China is very different in terms of how it's governed, but is that simply like that's in the national interest and that's how it's going to be?
Yeah, I think there's a strong buy-in from the people, first of all. So in China, they basically don't tolerate any dissenting opinions or any, there's basically one ideology that's permitted in China, and that's, you know, CCP's views. So that's kind of how it goes. And you'd imagine that that's a negative thing, but actually the public buy-in to that idea is quite good. And I suppose it's because of the economic success they've had and obviously the relative success they've had in controlling COVID.
Well, they don't have zero COVID as such, but they don't have what we have either. They're somewhere in the middle. What do they have? What would you describe it as?
Yeah, so I think what they're doing really is because of their digital infrastructure is so well developed, and there's several other reasons, which I'll kind of outline for you in a minute, they're able to respond very quickly to any localized outbreaks. And their health infrastructure is also very well developed. They don't have primary care facilities, but they do have a lot of these kind of smaller hospitals, and people will go for regular testing there. It's kind of like a cyclical testing program. And if they do find out any asymptomatic cases within that, they'll kind of lock down that area and then do this massive batch testing program. So you've seen two, since kind of their opening up post-lockdown, you've seen two major clusters. One was in Beijing and one was in the more recent one in Qingdao after the national holidays. And they've contained them, what appears to have contained them very, very well. And basically what they do is they just go back into localized lockdown and do the whole batch testing. So they'll actually test everyone in that area. So in Qingdao, it's like 9 or 10 million people. They'll just pool all the testing together. So they'll take, like, let's say 500 or 1,000 samples, put them in together and do one test. And if they find any people within that 1,000 sample, they'll say, OK, look, we have a cluster here. Let's figure out exactly where it is. And they'll concentrate their contact tracing efforts on that as well.
What you describe is obviously something that we should aspire to. But when you look at Ireland, 6 weeks into going into our second kind of lockdown of 6 weeks, are we just simply doing that to catch a breath? And do in 6 weeks, is there enough time in place to come up with a system that means that we can have localized lockdowns and really effective contact tracing? Or do we need to be more realistic and honest with people that this is going to take longer?
Yeah, I think the latter there, we need to be a bit more honest with people, and we don't have the capacity in Ireland. It's something I would have been pretty open with people very early is in when people were touting the China model as being a feasible example or kind of path for Ireland, I would have completely disagreed with them that there's huge capacity differences between Ireland and China. We're literally probably a decade behind them in terms of our digital infrastructure and kind of our whole digital ecosystem. You know yourself, you've probably heard of companies like Alibaba and Tencent and their WeChat programs. They've penetrated so deeply into Chinese culture, and they're in every facet of life that when they were applying their their intervention measures, they've piggybacked off that infrastructure. We don't have that in place in Ireland, and then we also have things like GDPR to contend with, whereas China just doesn't have those issues. The telecommunication companies in China are all state owned. So there's no disconnect between we want that data and the data being in their hand, so they can, their contact tracers, they can superimpose all that tele, you know, that geosync data from the telecommunication companies on top of that. So they just, you know, if you look at the Wuhan example, they had, you know, the movements of every single person in and out of Wuhan, what tickets they bought, you know, who they spoke to on the phone. It's like real worrying, but also really effective.
Yeah, we early on, there was talk that we were following a South Korean model. I think we've changed to a North Korean model since, but we were following a South Korean model. Their surveillance, and you look at China, it is surveillance society. It's not something we'd like here. The jury is out on whether contract tracing app is doing any good here, but we can't go that route in China. We can't go the same route. We don't have the same draconian system in place that everybody's data can be tracked. So what is our option?
That's a good question. I don't have the answer to be honest, Martin. Look, there's no easy answers to give on that type of question. I think it comes down to the fundamental questions about COVID is, you know, what is your strategy to save people's lives, or is your strategy to, you know, maybe make some hard kind of decisions that maybe will end up with people dying? So I have the answer to that. We're working on kind of opposing models as well. We have people telling us that the imperial model is rubbish, and that the, you know, the forecast on the large number of deaths was likely, you know, wrong. Mm. So it's a wonder, are we operating under the assumptions of the imperial model in Ireland, or is it, you know, I don't know is the answer. But lots of questions I have, but not good answers.
But I suppose to push back and just say, okay, we don't have the answer for that, but somewhere we have the worst. When you're trying to sit on two stools at the same time, that's just terrible. And we seem to be in that now at the moment, and that's really, really stupid. But on the flip side of that, just to put the argument forward, China's economy bounced back very strongly when they rolled out the thing. Like, can you give us a flavor of some of the sort of what we would call a success story there?
Well, I think you just look at their GDP growth. I think they're the only country, major economy in the world, that will experience positive GDP growth in comparison to last year, which is astounding, because they would have been, you know, most likely to be worst hit by it, being the epicenter and the, you know, the origin of this whole pandemic. So if you look, I mean, the major things you're seeing in China is obviously push towards, you know, digitalization. So the big tech companies here, like Alibaba, Tencent, ByteDance, which would be TikTok, you know, Douyin, they're all have done extremely well. If you look at their stock prices or their share prices on the stock market, they're gone up, I think, in the last 6 months by, you know, $100 for Alibaba. So it's like 50% up over the last 6 months. So yeah, they're doing really well. And off the back of that, you're seeing, you know, the Chinese people themselves, they're doing pretty well.
Can I ask, are Chinese people living for a vaccine coming out? I mean, we seem to be, everything seems to be pinned on a vaccine by this time next year. Are Chinese people doing the same?
Well, actually, the Chinese already have a vaccine. So there's, I think, close to 300,000 or 400,000 people have been vaccinated here in China already. And in various provinces, they have emergency use authorizations for it. So in the province where I was mostly based, Zhejiang, they have an emergency use authorization for all their hospital staff in high-risk scenarios. So most of the doctors and nurses who will be facing potential cases will all have been vaccinated. And then in other provinces, they've vaccinated the whole populations. I think a lot of their soldiers that have been vaccinated. And according to the official timeline from the government and their sign-off form, I think they're looking at the end of November for a more scaled out vaccination program where it will be commercially available. And I think it's going to be about 130 or 140 euro, and it's going to require two doses. That's what they're saying. Their reporting on it is that there's no major adverse side effects from it, and that it appears that there's been no reinfection post-vaccination, which it would appear that it works. I think you'd need longer term data to get a better idea of how will work play out long term, let's say.
Well, like 400,000 people have been effectively human trial at such a huge level. At that level, you would anticipate we'll get results pretty quickly, whether there's reinfections or reinfection is possible. We are also obviously. You refer to China as the epicenter where it began. How is the national mood in terms of their satisfaction with how it was handled and how it was dealt with? And I know that's a broad question, but we've seen across the globe places that have done well with it. You know, people have felt more solidarity, and you see where places, you know, you've seen also where it's not done so well. You've seen, unfortunately, the growth of dissent and trouble on the streets and the likes of that.
Yeah, I mean, case in point, New Zealand, she got voted in by a landslide for her second term, isn't that correct?
Since they moved to proportional voting, it's the highest vote ever achieved since in the history of New Zealand, since they moved to proportional voting, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's the same. You can kind of mirror it in China. I think initially there was some skepticism about the response. It's hard to get a gauge of because, public forums and internet forums are obviously very carefully regulated in China. So you don't get a true idea of what public mood is. But I think when they saw how things were playing out in Europe and America, I think they were like, oh, yes, we've done really well. So yeah, overall, I think if you speak to your average Chinese person, you'll find they're pretty happy with it, their system, and they're proud is the kind of overriding feeling you get.
So there's a sense of national pride that they've dealt with it on that level. Just in terms of coming back to Ireland again, and my reference to trying to sit on two stools at the same time, if I was to turn around to you and say, Paul, tell me what you think we need to focus on majorly between now and the spring, where would you start looking first and foremost?
I think we need to start looking towards expanding our testing regimens. We're very reliant on the PCR testing, which overall it's a decent test method, but there are other methods we can be using, like antigen testing, which are very rapid and they're easier to scale out. And I think they've got similar levels of accuracy as the PCR test when it's done correctly and when it's the correct kind of platform being used. So I would see that as one area. Obviously, the contact tracing thing, it's obvious. Like if they don't have enough people to do it, they just need to hire more people, or else they need to develop some kind of IT system over the next several weeks, I suppose. I would consider asking for, I think they outsourced the app to some Tremor company. Is that correct?
That's right.
The last app. Mm-hmm. I'd maybe consider bringing in, I'm not dissing that people now or anything, but maybe a larger tech company to scale it up and make it a bit more comprehensive. And as I said, piggyback maybe off existing infrastructure. I think maybe like even the likes of Google or Apple are available on our.
Well, unfortunately, we've lost Paul. These are the perils of doing everything online these days. But you know what? Actually, to be able to speak to him in Shanghai and get an insight into it is plenty interesting. What do you think, Martin?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I thought that they've rolled out a vaccine. Is interesting, Tony. I'm not one of those people that thinks there's going to be a vaccine here anytime quick. I just don't see how the logistics of scaling up to give everybody in the world a vaccine can be done in 12 months. I just don't see it in 12 months. I think maybe 24 months is more realistic timeline. And therefore you plan for 24 months rather than for 12.
Well, it's just, China is a country of over a billion people. So it's a lot of people. But to have rolled it out to nearly 500,000 people is pretty, pretty significant. So there's no two ways about addressing that up. That is really significant. We go one more time, Paul. obviously Ireland needs to improve its track and trace. Ireland needs to have its systems looked at about what we can do. We tried to balance that up. You know, we talked to people in the Irish civil liberty organizations and what does that mean for how we're monitored. But what I'm really interested in is the fact that you've seen successful localized lockdowns, and we have a shared border on the island of Ireland, obviously. And I hate using the phrase the island of Ireland, but nonetheless, here we are. This entity. How do we approach that if we were to, what learnings can we look at what was successful in localizing lockdowns and making sure, because that in effect is a border in itself, surely.
Yeah. So, in China, obviously, they use the military. I don't know how well that will go down in Ireland. That's the main issue in Ireland, I suppose. It's a political issue, you know, a scientific or medical issue. But in China, obviously, they literally just placed people along the border with barricades and locked all the, was able to leave, essentially. I don't know, an occupying force, you know, on the border. If it was the Irish army, it might be different. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So no, like, I mean, your line is breaking up a bit there, but just to say, the idea of bringing the military onto the streets in Ireland is very problematic. And in the communities that we're talking about, it's highly problematic. So that's not really an option. But in terms of an all-Ireland approach then, you know, when you think we were able to have an all-Ireland approach when it came to foot and mouth, why can't we have this when it comes to something like a pandemic?
Yeah, look, it's difficult to, I suppose, you'd need to have inner knowledge there of the workings of healthcare systems and what, you know, infrastructure is in place on both sides to see if they're compatible. I've heard the foot and mouth thing brought up a lot of times, but I don't know how it was done. I was only a young fella when that was happening. So I remember them looking at spraying under some cars and stuff. All right. But I think it's a different matter when you have, let's say, people who are asymptomatic carrying it. It's a harder one to deal with than animals, let's say. So I know there's comparisons made there, but I feel it's not comparable.
Last question for me, and it's something that we've heard a bit in Ireland now. In terms of the virus being airborne and the need for ventilation, what is the logic there? Have you seen that this is the case? Or because, excuse me, I know Orla Hegarty has said around the buildings how we need ventilation, proper ventilation. Is that something that is concerning?
Yeah, well, I think we've known about this for actually a long time, but maybe it hasn't become a major issue. But they've had enough case studies done in the cruise ships and in the previous SARS outbreak in 2003 in some, you know, kind of apartment complexes in Hong Kong and stuff, where they're able to show that the only way someone could have got infected, they hadn't any close contact, was the ventilation system. So I think there's even more knowledge, you know, kind of information coming out from kind of mechanistic studies where they're showing how the virus might be aerosolized or droplet spread and things like that, and that it can flow or it can get carried by air currents quite far. The implications would be, you know, obviously outdoor is more safer than indoor, and that if you're indoor, you want to keep this space ventilated.
Keep your windows open. We're having problems with the line, so we won't delay much more. If I saw that we sit here now, day one, lockdown, 6 weeks. You've friends and family here, Paul. You're looking across. What is your hope to see in the next few weeks from the Irish government's policy in terms of COVID?
I think it's like you said, we just choose one path, either go the Swedish path or go to, you know, develop the capacity to go the other way. But you're this kind of middle path of rolling lockdowns is it's going nowhere except to, you know, destroying our economy, having everyone out of work and piling misery upon misery. So it's just hard decisions. Someone's going to have to be a strong leader and take responsibility and some accountability for what's going on. I think we're lacking that. That's the problem with Ireland at the moment. We just have a lack of leadership at all levels. So I hope to see something done.
We spoke to João Pino in Portugal yesterday, and João is part of the socialist government over there. And he reckons that the problem is that they've started by thinking about money instead of thinking about saving people. Their first thought is money. And they have a phrase over there, deficit be damned. Save people first, worry about the money afterwards. Whereas here we seem to have started with money. What's the old Irish question? How are you going to pay for that? And it is colouring everything they do, absolutely everything they do.
Yeah, look, Mar, I agree with you and I agree with that sentiment. Look, if you said to me, you like both my parents would be high risk, they're, you know, my father's over 80 and he's got comorbidities and my mother's, you know, about the same age. So I don't want to, I'd never just say, look, let's go the Swedish route, because I feel like, you know, that those chickens could come home to roost in a very personal way if one of your own family got infected and, you know, God forbid something happened to them. But at the same time, look, you leaders kind of have to overlook those parts. And in all of medicine, we make hard decisions. You make decisions on a daily basis about, you know, what at a public health level, what drugs are we going to allow to be sold to the public? And there's drugs. Are those drugs good? If they're going to have to factor that into our decisions here as well. That's done in medicine all the time. It's no difference. It's not a massive departure from normal circumstances. We tend to frame everything in the light of excess debts, but excess debts have to be taken on a specific timeline. And if you frame excess debts, let's say in a 2 to 3 month timeline, yes, it will look like a very stark, you know, these people are dying very quickly. But if you take that over a year, you'll probably see no spike in excess debts because as we're seeing, these people are very sick. The people who are dying are very sick. So look, that's all I have to say on that point. It's not something I would make the decision myself, but I hope that that's what leaders are for, you know.
It's a deeply unpleasant thought, isn't it? It's a deeply unpleasant thought that when we boil it down to some of these levels, the choices that are, and it is quite stark, you're right. It's starting to come home to roost in Sweden as it stands. So there, people are saying that, you know, that Tegnell, has he got it wrong now? They're starting to question when you look at their numbers and where they are. But we won't really know. Let's tell the truth on this. We won't know a lot of this for a number of years before we get the data on a global scale and it's able to be analyzed. So, but the other thing is, yeah, the deficit, Martin's always the deficit be damned, but there's also a deficit of leadership and we do need a clear direction and a plan for where we're going. Paul, the line has been quite bad, so I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. We're gonna wrap it up, but we will touch base with you hopefully in a few weeks and see. Just hopefully now you're out and enjoying some daylight in the near future. And you know, it'll be lovely to see that an economy in Shanghai is actually operating where people can go and socialize, because that's the thing that we're losing sight of out here. You know, I've seen pictures from New Zealand where people are at rugby matches and the stadium is full. I'm seeing pictures of people shopping in Shanghai and the shops are full. We're losing that perspective here. We don't see it and we need to have that conversation.
Completely. There is light at the end of the tunnel. We just, you know.
Paul O'Brien, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, and mind yourself.
Thanks,
okay? Martin. Take care. Obviously, folks, we had a lot of issues with our line with Paul in Shanghai, but we really appreciate him taking the time to chat with us again. As I said at the outset, this weekend I will complete the virtual Dublin Marathon, and with that, that will be 2,020 miles run in all of 2020. All funds raised are going to Inner City Helping Homelessness and Analifi drug service providers. These people are phenomenal. They're doing great work all through the pandemic. They are on the front line. Please, please, please go to tortoiseshack.ie/run2020. Actually, for the 2 weeks that are in it, any of the donate buttons that are on the Tortoise Shack on tortoiseshack.ie, you hit them, the funds are going directly to Anna Liffey and ICHH. We have managed to raise over €6,000 so far. I want to see that smashed. Please help us out. I'm going to finish that run. You got to put your hands in your pocket. Thanks for the support. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.